This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Mali's interim leader is sworn into office, we'll ask what will happen to the north of the country still occupied by rebel forces. We'll also be asking, how do you remarket a hotel following a high-profile scandal? And in this Titanic year of memorials, we'll explore one story you may not have known about the fated ship's maiden and obviously only voyage. It's Thursday, so we'll be talking design. Today we'll be checking in with Michael Webb, founder of Archigram, to ask whether architecture criticism still has relevance. And have you ever wondered how the world might end? We'll talk to author David Darling, who's been exploring the likelihood of some lesser-known theories. Plus, there'll be a song or two right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But before all of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines.
Monocle 24 News. Syrian troops have held their fire in the hours after a UN-backed ceasefire took effect at dawn on Thursday. A report on state media that a so-called terrorist bomb destroyed an army bus and killed a senior officer in Aleppo after the truce began raised a possibility that troops would keep a pledge to hit back. State media also reported a bomb wounding officers near Idlib and a ruling party member shot dead in Deraa in the south. The opposition have described the ceasefire as only partially observed due to the army's failure to leave the streets. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has said he's considering changes either to the 2014 timetable for a presidential election or the transition of security to Afghan forces. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has said he's considering changes either to the 2014 timetable for a presidential election or the transition of security to Afghan forces in the same year in an attempt to avoid overburdening the country. Fear is mounting among Afghans and foreign governments that the planned pullout of most NATO combat troops by the end of 2014 and an election in the same year could see the country engulfed in conflict and authorities too stretched to maintain control. Speaking at a joint news conference with NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Mr. Karzai said he had been discussing the issue with his close advisers for some time. Mr. Rasmussen said he was confident the full transition to Afghan soldiers and police would be completed by the end of 2014.
NATO is here as Afghanistan's partner for the long term. That's our message to the people of Afghanistan, to the enemies of Afghanistan, and also to Afghanistan's neighbors.
NATO nations have been planning to build the Afghan police and army to a force of about 352,000 and then scaling them back as they hope the security threat fades and as financial support shrinks from the West. A former Labour activist, Diankunda Traore, has been sworn in as interim president of the West African country of Mali. As Speaker of the National Parliament, he inherits power from the leaders of a coup last month, which backfired by strengthening the very rebellion they wanted to destroy. Northern Tuareg rebels and their allies are now in effective control of three-quarters of the country. In the capital, Bamako, anger at the violence in the north is growing, and a string of protests have been held in support of a new government that's hoped will take control. Ivorian reggae singer Tiken Jafakoli, who lives in exile in Bamako, said the rebels did not have the interests of Mali at heart and criticised the Tuareg's imposition of Sharia law.
We are fighting for development. We are fighting and our population can live in the best condition. We don't need any religious trouble here. So I'm completely opposed that Sharia come in Africa.
Joe, Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has suspended military operations against rebels in the eastern North and South Kivu provinces following a spate of desertions in the army. The eastern region of the Central African country remains unstable nearly 10 years after the signing of a peace deal ending a wider war, and Congolese troops and UN peacekeepers regularly clash with several rebel groups. One of the most iconic images in art history, The Scream by Norwegian artist Edvard Munch, is up for sale. Munch painted four versions of the famous image in the 1890s. Three are in a museum. The other has been in Norway's Olsen family for 70 years until now. The father of current owner Petter Olsen was a friend and patron of Munch, and the proceeds from the sale will be used to create a new gallery in Norway dedicated to the artist. Sotheby's senior director Philip Hook told correspondents it was the most important work the auction house had handled.
It's the beginning of man sort of looking in on himself as opposed to painting the outside of himself, i.e. nature. And it is the ultimate first image of angst and anxiety. It's the alienation of modern man. It's actually, if you like, it's the face that launched 1,000 therapists.
The picture is expected to fetch $80 million at next month's auction. And those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. If anyone has spare $80 million, why not? You know, someone's got to buy it. Now, here's Thomas Schaffnacker with the latest world weather.
Well, Europe is currently in a period of very unsettled weather. If you're thinking about going to the Mediterranean, you might have to be prepared for some bad weather. Currently, over the Atlas Mountains of North Africa, we're seeing the beginnings of a storm which, when fully blown, will affect much of the Mediterranean over the weekend. Downpours and some flooding even likely in parts of Italy, for example. Now, Friday's City Outlook calls for rain showers in Rome, 13 degrees. In Barcelona, 16, also some showers. Zurich, 11 degrees with rain showers. And in London, 13 with some sunshine and also passing shower clouds. Now, North America, nice weather in the Big Apple this weekend. Friday, Saturday and Sunday looking mild and quite sunny, but breezy. And similar weather down most of the Atlantic seaboard. In California, however, we're talking tornadic weather. Heavy thundershowers recently spawned a tornado near San Francisco. Just a small one, but it indicates how volatile the weather is in California right now. The good news is that the weekend is looking better in California. It's Friday's City Outlook. In San Francisco, still rain and 11 degrees. Houston, Texas, 30 with sunshine. New York City and Washington, D.C., 17 and sunny. Holiday spots around the globe now for the next few days. In Hawaii and Honolulu, if you're lucky enough to be here, sunny skies and 29 degrees. In Kingston, Jamaica, it's 28 with lots of rain showers here at the moment, more to come. Phuket and Koh Samui, similar weather here, around 32 degrees with sunshine and occasional tropical showers. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffnacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. It is 18.08 here in London, 13.08 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. The hospitality industry is one that prides itself on reputation. But what happens when a hotel becomes synonymous with scandal or drama? The Hotel Carlton in Lille is one such example, now associated with an alleged prostitution ring in which the former head of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, was allegedly involved. It joins the long list of establishments which have become associated with infamous events, for better or worse. The Beverly Hilton Hotel, where Whitney Houston was recently found dead. The Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, where Martin Luther King was shot. The Taj Hotel in Mumbai, which was attacked in 2008. And the Sofitel New York Hotel, another of Strauss-Kahn's unfortunate associations. So, how should hotels re-market themselves after such an event? And is it always such a bad thing for their PR? Joining me now on the line is Mark Bukowski, author and founder of Bukowski PR. Mark, welcome to Midori House. If you were advising a hotel right now that was that had been sort of lapped up in a scandal, what would be your first piece of advice?
Well, stay calm and look at the ways that we could market this to our advantage. I think in every disaster there is an opportunity. I think Brendan Behan once said the only bit of bad publicity is the obituary notice. And I think here we are relating to a very exotic event that happened into this hotel. It's how you change possibly your marketing. I mean, you know, clearly, if you're an exclusive hotel, and many hotels around the world are, would rather not look for any publicity in any shape or form and remain aloof and ultra cool about it, then clearly you've got a problem. But the Hotel Maurice back in the 50s benefited from Salvador Dali bringing in animals and women and drawing on the walls, and I think people flocked to go to such a hotel in the same way that Beverly Hills Hotel, one of the finest hotels in the world, relished that their reclusive guest was Howard Hughes and made a benefit of the three or four bungalows that he kept up. Whether he was there or not, The mystery was then given. But it needs an energy and it needs a confidence about how you market what is a scandal rather than running away from it and hoping it will go away.
But I mean, the examples you just gave there are, on the whole, sort of fairly good, positive things that have happened to those hotels. If you were to look at, say, the Hotel Carlton now in Lille, that's a little bit trickier for them to work out what to do next, isn't it?
Well, certainly you've got to understand where the story is running. You've got to understand the long tail that some of these stories have, and of course, you know where it fits in and what the negativity. But you've got to embrace it. You can't say this thing didn't happen, and obviously for legal reasons, you've got to take a very clear understanding of exactly what happened. You've got to be transparent. You've got to be truthful and honest, and you've got to project, you know, the positivity around the notoriety in the sense of actually using it to market what you're going to kick out, and possibly if this incident allegedly had happened or taken place, you've got to put obviously a positive story about how this would never happen again and look at a ways of actually distancing yourself from the story rather ignoring the fact that it happened. But then you've got to kick in and actually then, you know, aggressively go into a PR and a marketing campaign to address the attributes of what your establishment actually stands for and give it a position and give it a place for what we can do. I mean, hotels are no shortage to quite a lot of negative publicity, and not forgetting the digital age, the power of TripAdvisor, where TripAdvisor is turning reputations inside out, and we've seen the mistakes that people have actually made in the travel industry to try and, you know, be deceitful about the way that the honest reviews have been taken and played with it. So, it, luxury is clearly the element of what we're playing with here, and luxury brands, you know, have a more difficult chart across the sort of turbulent waters.
When we look at what happened at the Sofitel New York Hotel with Dominic Strauss-Kahn, or what did or didn't happen then, do you think that there's a possibility that some of their higher end customers will now think twice about, is that somewhere I really want to stay? There's some questions over, you know, their security. Maybe I should just, go next door instead to the Standard or something.
Well, of course they're going to think that. So you've got to communicate and change their minds. You've got to demonstrate what you're going to do to challenge the rumours and the negativity. And you've got to take the best parts of the hotel and start marketing it and actually take away the negativity by producing a campaign or perhaps even a series of stunts or an online campaign that actually positioned, you know, arguments against what the current attitude is towards the hotel. You can't avoid it. You have to take it on board and actually start transmitting positive memes about the attributes of the hotel rather than getting submerged by the toxicity of publicity.
Is it possible also that people might just forget what has happened at some of these places? I mean, this isn't a hotel, but the sushi restaurant in London where Alexander Litvinenko was killed by by the Russian spy agency. You would think that that sushi place would not be somewhere where you'd really want to go anymore, but it's still open and it's still doing really well.
We're in a 24/7 media world, accelerated by social and digital, and of course, a crisis on the day it breaks looks awful. But actually, with strong husbandry and a clear message and a clear dimension, you can move through these things. And as far away you can get from the incident and be clever about the way you market it, a disaster can be avoided. But if you haven't addressed the issues, and if there are real security issues, there are real problems, if you don't address them and they come back to haunt you, then there is a bigger hill to climb in terms of regaining a reputation.
Mark Bukowski, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. After the break, we'll have a rather nice song. But first, there's this.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand. Some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Berenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, I promised you a good song, and it is. It's a cracker. We're going to be talking about Mali in a little moment. A lot of bad stuff has been happening in Mali over the last 3 weeks. But I thought it was important to show the best side of what is a wonderful nation, particularly when it comes to music. So this is Wiley Katasso by the absolutely brilliant Amadou and Miriam. Brilliant. That was Wiley Katasso by the wonderful Amadou and Mariam. You're listening to Monocle 24. Mali's brief dalliance with military rule came to an end earlier today when the West African country's parliamentary speaker, Dion Kunda Traore, was sworn into office. The man he took over from, Captain Amadou Sanogo, was at the ceremony, and he had ruled Mali for less than 3 weeks. But during that short time, Tuareg rebels stormed through the north of the country, capturing several major towns and declaring an independent state. As a result, 70-year-old Traore, who speaks 6 languages, has quite a job on his hands as Mali's new president. Joining me now on the line is Camilla Toulmin, director of the International Institute for the Environment and Development. Camilla, welcome. Traore has threatened, as he calls it, total and relentless war to try and win this territory back. How difficult is it likely for him, to actually do that?
I think it will be extremely difficult. Mali is an enormous country. The northern half is more than the size of France, and you're looking at a very vast territory, very few towns, quite difficult, I think, to establish and push back the rebel forces. My feeling is that this may be more of a negotiation tactic with the Tuareg rebels to encourage them to come to some kind of political solution.
And is there likely to be much pressure on Mali and the new president Traoré to actually do that, to negotiate with the Tuareg? Is there a sense of within the region that the last thing anyone needs right now, particularly after everything that's happened in Libya next door, is another bloody civil war?
Well, indeed. I think if it was just the Tuareg rebels who were at play in the north, that we would find a negotiated solution was the most likely outcome. What's more complex, though, is that alongside the Tuareg rebels, who are very much secular, is a set of Salafist Islamic fighter groups who are much more closely allied to Al-Qaeda. They have been in the region, coming in from southern Algeria for the last 5 or 8 years, responsible for a lot of kidnappings, probably engagement in a lot of the cross-Saharan drug trade. And their idea is to establish Sharia law throughout the whole of Mali. Now, I think they're going to be very tough to dislodge. They also seem to be bringing in fighters from the northern Nigerian group Boko Haram that have successfully bombed a number of cities in Nigeria. So the whole thing could get quite messy.
And does Mali have the resources, the military resources, if necessary, to actually fight back? Or are they actually going to be slightly outnumbered?
I think they would certainly be outgunned in their current form. Of course, the reason that Amadou Sanogo led the coup back 3 weeks ago, it's amazing what happens in 3 weeks.
Well, quite.
3 weeks ago, was a sense of deep frustration amongst the army that the government had not been listening to their demands for better material, better equipment, better means to fight the rebels. Now, I mean, they're going to need some pretty rapid upgrading of military supplies if they're going to be able to take on a very battle-hardened and effective group of Tuareg and the Salafis who've had an awful lot of practice in the last few years, the Tuareg particularly, because they've been key members of the Gaddafi fighting forces, which has given them plenty of time to
plenty of battle experience.
Their skills, yeah.
Why has Captain Sanogo sort of decided to hand over after, you know, it is just about 3 weeks, probably the one of the shortest periods of time as a head of state, officially or otherwise. Because obviously, you know, he was at the ceremony when Traoré was sworn in. You know, he hasn't been arrested. Did he just feel that actually he'd sort of bitten off more than he could chew?
I think that's certainly one of the things. I think another is that I don't think he was interested in power per se. I think he was interested in trying to demonstrate this deep sense of frustration that the army wasn't getting what it needed. I think he also hadn't perhaps thought through in detail what the next steps would need to be. So he found that the politicians in Mali just refused to play ball with him at all. And so his plans to set up some kind of interim administration just met a complete blank wall. At the same time, all of the neighboring countries of the region put up a blockade for finance, for trade, for people, which meant that Mali became totally isolated. So I think he thinking about the good of his country, and I believe he was really concerned about the good of his country, he thought, actually, the best thing I can do is to stand aside so that we can get a government into position that can really take the battle to the rebels.
You mentioned the neighbouring countries who've got together to put together a package of economic sanctions while Sanogo was in charge, and made it pretty clear, you know, through the regional grouping ECOWAS, that they weren't going to accept it. Do you detect a sort of a bit of a shift in, a generational shift in leadership within West Africa that doesn't accept these sorts of coups anymore?
I think that's very much the case. I found it deeply impressive. Of course, you have to remember that none of those other neighbouring countries want to see something like this happen in their own countries.
So no, of course.
The head of the ECOWAS grouping at the moment is Alassane Ouattara, who from Ivory Coast, who faced not a dissimilar problem when his winning of the elections 18 months ago was not recognized by his predecessor. So all of these heads of state have got a very strong interest in demonstrating to their own armies and their own people that they won't put up with this kind of thing.
Now, there were supposed to be elections in Mali anyway within the next few weeks. Do you think that elections will happen quite soon? And is it going to be possible to do that while half the country is technically not under central control?
Well, it's certainly not possible to have nationwide elections when half of the country's territory is occupied by a rebel force. So no, it would be completely impossible to have national elections as had been envisaged. So I think they'll have to set up some sort of interim administration that draws in many of the senior political figures, but a full nationwide election is going to have to wait until some kind of either military or political negotiation has succeeded with the Tuareg rebels.
Camilla Toulmin, Director of the International Institute for the Environment and Development, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Hagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkshire.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalavet, Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
In the next half hour on Midori House, even, we'll hear about Lebanon's Titanic victims, we'll talk design criticism with Michael Webb, and we'll also be discussing some of the bizarre theories about the end of the world. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Syrian troops have held their fire in the hours after a UN-backed ceasefire took effect at dawn on Thursday. A report on state media that a so-called terrorist bomb destroyed an army bus and killed a senior officer in Aleppo after the truce began raised a possibility that troops would keep a pledge to hit back. State media also reported a bomb wounding officers near Idlib and a ruling party member shot dead in Deraa in the south. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has said he's considering changes either to the 2014 timetable for a presidential election or the transition of security to Afghan forces in the same year in an attempt to avoid overburdening the country. Fear is mounting among Afghans and foreign governments that the planned pullout of most NATO combat troops by the end of 2014 and an election in the same year could see the country engulfed in conflict and authorities too stretched to maintain control. A former Labour activist, Yonkunda Traore, has been sworn in as interim president of the West African country of Mali. As Speaker of the National Parliament, he inherits power from the leaders of a coup last month, which backfired by strengthening the very rebellion they wanted to destroy. Iran's government is expected to start buying hundreds of thousands of tons of feed grains, as Western sanctions are causing enormous disruption to the financing of the country's imports. Traders say Iranian farmers face a shortage of feed for their huge livestock flocks, as private sector grain importers are unable to arrange payments. The Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has suspended military operations against rebels in the eastern North and South Kivu provinces following a spate of desertions in the army. The eastern region of the Central African country remains unstable nearly 10 years after the signing of a peace deal ending a wider war. And one of the most iconic images in art history, The Scream by Norwegian artist Edvard Munch, is up for sale. The picture is expected to fetch $80 million at an auction next month. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, this month marks the 100-year anniversary of the worst sea disaster of the 20th century, the sinking of the Titanic. It's an event which has become infamous, memorialised through Hollywood, but there's one group of passengers who often go unnoticed, those from the Arabic-speaking world. Records suggest that all but one of the Arabic passengers on board the Titanic, of which there were over 80, came from what's now known as Lebanon. It's believed that only 30 of them survived. Joining me now in the studio is Monocle's Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm, who's currently in London. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Steve.
Thanks very much for coming in. This story about the Lebanese passengers on the Titanic, is this a story well known in Beirut? Because it's not really well known elsewhere.
Well, I have to admit, I didn't know about it, but I have a few Titanic buff friends. So I called them up and they told me, yeah, so there was a lot of Lebanese on that boat, which I had no idea. But it does make sense because 1912 was a tough period, a lot of immigration to the States, like massive immigration, which continued during World War One. There was a huge famine. There's a lot of economic, a bit like Ireland. So a lot of Lebanese left for the States. At the time, they weren't recorded as Lebanese. They would be Turks or Syrian because it was still the Ottoman Empire. But a lot emigrated to America. They went to New York. They went to Dearborn. And in fact, my grandfather was on the sister ship of the Titanic in 1912. I think it was called the Olympia. I have some like recollection, but he
ship arrived got there fine.
Yeah, well, and he came back.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously, yes, the Titanic wasn't the only ship that was sailing to America right then. What do you know about his journey that he made there?
Actually, we have some letters and some postcards of the boat. So I think it's called the Olympia, and I think he was kind of flirting with some Irish women on the boat. And he opened some sort of like lace business in New York. And then his dad was like, the First World War started and he's like, you have to come back to Lebanon. You need to help us. So he actually came back, but he wasn't happy. I think he had a great time in New York, far from his family.
I'm sure he did.
But a lot of Lebanese from the mountains were very impoverished. There was famine coming. The Ottomans were very tough on Lebanon during World War One. One third of the population died. So there was a huge wave which started actually at the end of the 19th century going to America, but also South America. So they would travel on boats across the Atlantic, including Titanic.
And this is partly why we see such large numbers of Lebanese diaspora all over the world,
yeah.
Whether you're in America, South America,
yeah.
Somewhere in West Africa. What is it about the Lebanese now that makes... that makes that diaspora so important?
Well, I mean, they still keep quite strong ties with Lebanon, so that's why. And the Lebanese love to claim anyone that's famous, that's Mexican or Brazilian or anything.
And who's got a slight connection that you can claim as Lebanese.
My dad even claims Che Guevara as Lebanese. So.
Really?
Yeah, it needs to be proven.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that one. And going back to the Titanic, I mean, has there been much in Lebanon about, I mean, because in the UK, in the US, there's been huge amounts about the Titanic's 100-year anniversary. From the rather bizarre things, like in Belfast, they've celebrated the fact that they built such an amazing ship, despite the fact that obviously its steering wasn't perhaps quite so hot. Has there been a lot of coverage in Lebanon of the commemorations, and has that been linked at all to those that were travelling?
Well, I must say, I had no idea. I didn't read anything in the press, but I think with the Titanic fans, and there are some in Lebanon and in the Middle East, this is a famous story. I had no idea, but they did. The government, the Lebanese government, is not doing anything to celebrate. There's no like national commemoration. Maybe it would warrant, but I guess we're too busy with other things.
Yeah, you've got other things to worry about perhaps at the moment. I mean, is there... does it surprise you at all that no one, particularly in the West, makes more of the fact that there were Lebanese and Arab passengers on the boats? I mean, if you... Obviously, not that we can look at a James Cameron film and sort of judge it for its historical accuracy, but certainly whenever Titanic's talked about...
Well, Al Arabiya did a story, I think it was 2 days ago or something. Apparently, I've seen the Cameron movie, but a long time ago. Apparently, there's a 6-second clip of a like Lebanese couple like telling each other to like...
6-second clip?
To hurry up. Basically, I mean, the Lebanese that were traveling on the Titanic were very poor, so they were third class, and that's where most people died. And a lot of them didn't speak Arabic. Didn't speak English, so they didn't really understand what was going on and what to do. That's why so many died. There was this friend of mine, this Titanic buff. sent me the story of this woman who had survived, and she said the only reason she did was because she knew she was emigrating, so she had learned a bit of English, so she understood that she had to go on the boat, and her husband unfortunately didn't survive. But so that's the story. I mean, a lot of people didn't speak English, they were all in third class.
And so it goes.
And so it goes, yeah.
Carol Corm, thanks very much for joining us here in Midori House, on Midori House. After this short break, we're going to be talking design, so stay tuned.
Next week on Monocle 24, we're hijacking the second hour of The Globalist, bubble wrapping it carefully and taking it to the 51st Milan Furniture Fair, Salone del Mobile. We'll be coming to you live each day from 8 to 9 a.m. Central European Time, Tuesday to Friday, from the studios at Il Sole 24 Ore. Join me, Hugo MacDonald, as I bring you the best guests, news, views and reports as events unfold each day. That's at 8 a.m. Central European Time, here on Monocle 24.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, every Thursday on this show, we turn our attention to design. And today, we're going to take a look at a debate that's been rumbling on in the US and elsewhere about the quality and quantity of architecture and design journalism in the mainstream media. Far fewer publications now, it seems, have dedicated architecture or design correspondents. Joining me on the line to talk about this from Los Angeles is Michael Webb, the US editor of Architecture Review. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you think the mainstream press then, particularly newspapers, really are turning their back on architecture criticism?
I think that what is happening is that newspapers and the press in general are running scared. You know, they're seeing the monster of the internet overtaking them, taking away their readers, their advertisers. And they want to play it safe. They want to stay away from anything that is not broadly appealing. And I think that's now infected the quality press as well as the more popular papers. The New York Times has replaced its architecture critic after a long delay with an art critic who seems to have very little interest in architecture. Paul Goldberger, a wonderful writer, has left The New Yorker and gone to Vanity Fair, which did pay some attention to architecture, usually only when a celebrity was involved. So yes, there is a general decline. I don't know how it is in Britain right now. Last I saw, all the broadsheets had good architecture critics. Maybe that's not true anymore.
Why do you think that architecture criticism can be such a difficult pill to swallow for editors and indeed audiences? I mean, given that architecture is something that really affects us all.
I think it's a lack of engagement. Yes, it affects us, but can we affect architecture? With art, you've got something you can buy and sell, collect, put on a wall, show off to your friends. It's a possession. It's very profitable for dealers and sometimes occasionally for artists. But architecture is a functional thing that has to not only be to work. At least that should be the minimum requirement, that it does its job. If, in addition to that, it lifts the spirits the way a great building does, that's something of a rarity and something that a lot of people really don't pay much attention to. They're more concerned whether the, you know, building leaks or whether they can get up the stairs easily or whether the elevators work. Very, very low-grade elements, but everyday things that people do get engaged with.
I mean, is there an argument also that, you know, some architecture critics don't help themselves by, perhaps veering into too academic or technical analysis? I mean, there's that wonderful quote from the poet Adrian Mitchell that says, you know, most people ignore poetry because most poetry ignores people. Is there a similar argument to make about architecture critics?
I think many architects are poor communicators. I don't think that they reach out enough or use plain English to communicate what it is they're trying to do. However intelligent they may be, however concerned they may be to do a good job, to please the user and please the people who see the building every day, but they just don't communicate. And that's certainly true of academics, who often put a smokescreen around their work to make it look more serious, perhaps, than it is. No, critics, by and large, the ones I read anyway, write very well, are very much involved trying to bring in a larger audience. When I write about architecture, an architectural review, for example, I'm trying to share my enthusiasm and my passion for architecture, trying to get other people to, have the same pleasure from the building I'm describing as I do. So I don't think it's a fair criticism of critics that they don't communicate. I think the problem is that architecture as a subject just has not achieved the level of public awareness, public interest for editors of newspapers and magazines in general, to feel it's a worthy subject, something that they should devote space to.
Well, I mean, what would you do then? What would your advice be then to an editor who was umming and ahhing about whether to get rid of their architecture critic? What would you say to them about how they could perhaps change their coverage to ensure that they keep their audience?
Well, I think it's critically necessary to have an informed audience, whether it be in politics or, any kind of human activity. And architecture is, as you say, something that affects everybody. It shapes our lives, the places we live, the places we work, and, places we play. So it's very important to encourage the few good people and make more of their work and criticize the bad, of which there is a majority of. Most buildings are terrible, just as most art is terrible. But there has to be, it takes individuals, it takes really inspired exhibition curators to get people to come to see a show at an art museum of an artist they're not familiar with. And then they make a discovery for themselves, and then they go away and they tell their friends. And I think exactly the same is true of any kind of journalism, that you've got to excite people, to give them that sense. And the fact that you're talking about architecture without pictures is indicative. Mm. The fact that you think it's worth discussing, even though you can't show, alluring pictures of the latest hot new building, you're relying on people to use their own eyes to go out and, find these things for themselves. So it can be done. But it takes, as with anything else, a lot of energy and determination to make it happen. And good writing helps. If the piece reads well, as Paul Goldberger's columns do, then I think you hook your audience.
Michael Webb, US editor of Architecture Review, thank you very much for joining me on Midori House. And of course, if you want to hear more about design and architecture, every Tuesday at 1900 hours, is the premiere of Hugo MacDonald's Section D. You're listening right now, though, to Midori House. And it's about 1847 here in London, 1347 in New York City, if you are there. We're going to be talking about how the world might end in a moment. So, of course, there was only really one choice for a song. This is R.E.M. Go on, admit it, you were air drumming, weren't you? That was REM with It's the End of the World as We Know It. Now, predicting the end of the world has always been a popular pastime, but our next guest decided to work out just how likely some of those doomsday scenarios actually are. Astronomer and science writer David Darling wanted to understand the science behind some of the apparent threats to our future. He joins me on the line now. Welcome, David. Are we all doomed?
Well, we are eventually, yeah.
Great.
In the long future we are, but nothing to be worried about in the short term, I don't think.
Okay, good. In the short term, we're all fine. So let's talk about those long-term problems. What should we be worried about, or at least a little bit concerned about?
Well, I think there's some natural things that can happen, and there's some problems of our own making. And I personally think that the ones of our own making are the ones that are likely to happen first, things to do with our own technology. The natural ones, such as asteroid collisions and giant volcanoes and that kind of thing, they've happened in the past and they will happen again in the future. But we're talking about probably thousands or even millions of years in some cases. So they're sort of longer term things. It's the technology that I think we have to be more worried about.
Now, it's a decent year to be writing this book because the Mayan calendar suggests that 2012 is the year when frankly, we're all going to die. Was that your inspiration?
Absolutely, yeah. Pure commercialism there, I think. But it is a fun subject. I mean, there's been such nonsense talked about this Mayan calendar thing that we thought, well, why not put some real science behind it and look at the ways that actually the Earth, or at least the human race, could come to a sticky end, and not just look at the normal suspects like global warming or nuclear war, but look at some of the more of the interesting and unusual things that could happen.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the book is Mega Catastrophes, nine strange ways the world could end. Let's talk about one of those nine strange ways then, that are, you know, a little bit more technological.
Well, I think computers, for instance, are very interesting. We're getting more and more involved with computers. They're sort of taking over our lives, and you know, through Facebook and all sorts of things. And I think not too far down the road, we're going to have brain-computer links. Okay, is this where we can actually wear a little headset or some sort of device that connects us directly to a computer through our thought waves? And these things already exist. You can actually control computers in a simple way just by thinking about them, and that technology is going to develop very, very quickly.
Is this something that we'd wear, or would be like a chip inside?
Yeah, I think initially it'll probably be some sort of you know, small headset or device that you wear on the outside, but certainly further down the road, maybe 20, 30 years' time, I could see where you have a little chip or something implanted actually under the surface of the skin around the skull that will pick up signals much better. And I think in the future that could become just the norm. It sounds scary, it sounds horrendous at the moment, but the way things are progressing, that seems to be perfectly feasible to me.
Now, to be honest, it sounds scary and horrendous whether it's now or it's 100 years' time, having the idea of having a chip inside your brain. I'm naturally sceptical about all these things, mainly because I don't have a jetpack, and I'm fairly sure we were promised jetpacks by now.
Well, that's right, but you look at the rate at which computer technology has moved along. I mean, jetpacks are, the technology is difficult and they're dangerous and that sort of thing, whereas computer technology has moved along by leaps and bounds. If you just look back even 20 years ago, nobody really even heard of the internet then, or laptops or anything like that. Now they're commonplace. And the pace of development is so rapid, anything new that comes along, particularly it makes it easier to interact with the internet, is lapped up right away. So I think as soon as these devices become readily available, there'll be a huge market for them. And if you can connect and have instantaneous access to the world's knowledge directly into your brain, and all your friends are doing this, it's not going to be too long before you may want to do that as well. And I can see that being something we're looking at maybe 20, 30 years down the road. And the problem is, as soon as we can do that, as soon as everybody's brain is directly connected to the internet, then there's all sorts of problems could arise from that, because we know that computers can crash, they can get viruses, they can be manipulated by outside forces. So
none of this sounds very good, to be honest. Mm. Are you a natural worrier?
No, I'm a natural optimist, actually. So the book actually is quite lighthearted. We treat these things seriously, but at the same time with a sort of tongue-in-cheek attitude. So I'm very much of an optimist. But in the case of the computer, and one or two other things, I do think that they are more likely than not to happen. It doesn't make me necessarily scared of them, because I think we may get over these problems, but I think they're going to happen anyway.
Great. Okay, well, that's something to look forward to. Okay. You say you're a natural optimist, but reading your conclusion, you say we'll never be completely safe because the universe is by nature a hostile place, racked by huge explosions, strafed by deadly radiations, replete with objects hurtling around haphazardly at crazy speeds. That's what makes it so interesting.
Well, those are just facts. I mean, that actually is the case. I mean,
doesn't make me feel any better.
No, it doesn't. No, but the timescale involved in a lot of these things is quite large. So, I mean, the Earth has been pounded in the past by asteroids. I mean, they wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. We will be hit again in the future. It's inevitable. But at least now we know where these things are, and we can maybe do something about them. That's the good news. We're getting a bit smarter about how to detect them and maybe avoid them in the future.
Do you think if you had to look at the man-made problems and the potential just, environmental problems, natural problems, which are the more serious and which are the more likely to affect us in the, at least let's give it a time frame of the next 100 years?
Yeah, well, at the end of each chapter, we actually gave a little reading, between 0 and 10, the sort of scale on which we rank these things. And the one that came top was actually pandemics. So like drug-resistant infections and diseases, which have been very much in the news recently, that is a really nasty possibility that could come quite quickly, certainly within the 100-year time frame you're talking about, within a lifetime, really.
Yeah, so a SARS or a bird flu that actually becomes real rather than a bit of a scare.
Exactly, something like, say, the plague. If that got loose and we had nothing to treat it with, that would be a real problem.
Yeah, that would be a real problem. Well, David Darling, what a note to end on. Thank you. The book is Mega Catastrophes, 9 Strange Ways the World Could End. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
LDNTYO. NYC MT4.
So, hopefully you're still vaguely cheery after that. That's all for this edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Case Bilbao, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Sam Impey. At 2200 London time, that's in 3 hours, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be back here with the Monocle Daily. The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck is up next, right after the news. But from me, Steve Bloomfield, that's all for Midori House. Thanks for listening.